trust already with what Syracuse is like. I don't know if you've been there or not. It's very cloudy, a little bit run down. And then you come here on a day like this, and it would be really hard to drive back. So that was a wise decision. Before I say anything else, and I apologize to somebody who's from Syracuse here, and I just insulted you right off the bat. That wasn't my intent. Let me give a caveat that I need to give that President Bowen doesn't need to give. So these are going to be my views, and they're not the views of anyone else. I want to be really clear about that because I'm going to talk about too big to fail and issues of financial regulation and supervision. And just to be reiterated, so the Board of Governors has authority to write rules, issue rules, and determine what the Federal Reserve is doing in the areas of regulation. And I don't have that. That's not what we do at Reserve Banks, and I don't want anyone to confuse any of my views with what their views are. So I titled this talk today, The Four Questions of Too Big to Fail. So for those of you who are getting ready for your first data on Friday, I hope that sort of rings a bell. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then you'll just have to go on Google and figure that out. I told my son I was going to call it that, and he said, well, what if no one laughs? And I said, well, it'll be like most of my jokes, it'll be okay. So another comment, I apologize for any more Passover references that I make as I get ready. Okay, so what am I going to say? So what I'm going to go through, basically, so I appreciate the generous introduction, so let me take a step back here. So I've been working on the too big to fail issue more or less than my entire career at the Fed, and even before that, in that prior job I had. My sort of one claim to fame, if I have one, is Gary Stern and I wrote a book published by Brookings in 2004 called Too Big to Fail, The Hazards of Big Bank Bailouts. I think I don't remember the exact title now. And in that book, we argued that banks were becoming too big to fail, that there was going to be a big problem if they got in trouble. We sort of identified the issues around why they were getting too big to fail. Let me give you advice, two bits of advice based on that experience. First of all, don't write a book. It's extremely inefficient way of making a point. I would focus on op-eds and maybe a pamphlet, but I would definitely not write a book. And if you're going to get something right, like sort of calling the financial crisis and that large banks were going to be the center of it, I would not do that 4 years in advance. I would definitely do that like 6 months in advance. So those are two things I learned from there. But I also learned a couple other things, and they're sort of morphing into more recent work that the Minneapolis Fed has done on too big to fail. And so I'm going to focus, some of the comments are going to be informed by this prior work, and some of them are going to be informed by a specific plan that we've put forward about how we think we ought to solve too big to fail. Okay, so let's start here with the first question. So the first question is, why is too big to fail so hard to solve? This is important. It's important to really start with this question. Because I think if you don't have an understanding about why it's been so hard to solve, then you're likely to keep repeating sort of the approaches we've taken to date, which in our estimation haven't worked. So the short why, in this sort of long book that we wrote, not that long, I don't want to dissuade you from buying it, but, you know, in a relatively short, pithy book that we wrote, one of the things that we were talking about was, in the U.S. for a long time, the position was, the way that we'll get avoid pubic betrayal is we'll make a verbal commitment that we're not going to do it, and we'll set up a sort of arduous process by which bailouts have to, the process by which you have to approve a bailout. So in the U.S., you'd have to get successor entity that gets created is going to be capitalized right away. It's going to be capitalized by taking all of the bondholders and making them equity holders. That's how it's going to work. So why is that important? That's why you don't have bailout. The bondholders today become the equity holders of the future, and you don't need to tax anybody. It's all there. That is, we can talk about all these other things that they did. This is the linchpin for how we're going to avoid bailouts. Okay, so now this explains why I'm sort of emphasizing this credibility stuff. Because just to repeat, the plan is, in the middle of a financial crisis, where you may have J.P. Morgan in trouble, and State Street, and maybe U.S. Bank, and maybe Zions Bank, what you're going to do is you're going to convert the debt holders right away of J.P. Morgan Chase, you're going to convert them into equity holders. I'll just repeat. Our plan, coming off of the financial crisis, where we were unwilling to impose losses on fixed income holders, is to impose losses on fixed income holders. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I don't think I'm not making that up. I mean, that's what the plan is. And to repeat a little bit more, so for some of you who've been around, so I've been working on this issue for, I'm going to age myself, if the rest of my body hasn't already done that for you. I remember when there was a big push to have something called subordinated debt. And the idea was that we were going to have debt that was, we were going to require all financial institutions, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, big banks, they were going to issue debt that was going to be subordinated. So it was going to be low on the, it was going to be above equity, but it was going to absorb the losses. And actually, we had an experiment in the United States. We said that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were going to have to issue subordinated debt. They were a test case. So how many people here? How many people here were holding subordinated debt of Fannie and Freddie during the financial crisis? Any of you? Okay. You were, okay. Did you take any losses? No, you didn't. Maybe if you had sold it at the wrong time, if you held on, you would have been fine. Why? Because the debt that Fannie and Freddie had to sell, which explicitly said on it, if Fannie and Freddie go into something like conservatorship or receivership, is going to take the losses, was fully protected. So one thing I have the pleasure of doing every day is working with Neil Kashkari. So he's my boss at the Minneapolis Fed. And for those who don't know, Neil ran the TARP. So Neil was in all of the meetings. And so I said to him, Neil, what was the discussion like at Fannie and Freddie about when we took them over? What was the discussion like about imposing losses on subordinated debt holders? Not for a second. We never considered it for 1 minute. Why? Our job is to put the fire out, not to light the fire. Okay, so then why did you say that it was great? It was the best we could get. It was the best we could get. So what do they mean by that? They mean that what they really want to do is, if you ask them, we agree that the measure of the total amount of total loss absorbing capacity, that total amount that they need, the 23.5% of J.P. Morgan, that number sounds about right to us. But if we said it needed to be equity, that's a non-starter. So we made some of it debt, which is going to be cheaper. I guess cheaper initially. It's not going to be cheaper when you get close to the crisis, but fine. And that's what we need. Okay. That's going to set me up for this next point. So they'll say, what we should have done, if we could have, is we would have raised equity. Okay? Third question. I sort of emphasized credibility. So what is the credible way? I'm foreshadowing if you didn't pick that up. Equity. We need much higher equity funding in the United States. And maybe in other places too, but I'll spoke from the United States. Why? Because if you look at the history of the United States, if you take a firm into a resolution, almost always the equity holders are going to take huge hits. Almost always. There's some exceptions. Kind of Illinois, there was some protection for equity holders because of some rules. Certainly, if you don't take someone into resolution, then you're going to find a way to protect folks. But if you can take them into resolution and they are equity holders, the history of the United States is that, in fact, they'll take hits. That's the history of it. It's not like subordinated debt. It's not like other fixed income. So the question then is, how much more equity and why is that a good idea? Because, I mean, even if equity could be credible, it might be a bad idea to raise it too high, right? Maybe the costs exceed the benefits. So I'm going to talk to you. We have a whole plan on the Minneapolis Fed website, and it goes into excruciating detail about how we made these calculations that I'm going to talk to you about. So I'm just going to sketch it at a high level, and then maybe we can have a give and take, and if I can remember exactly how we did the calculations, I'll tell you if that's your question, but it's all in there. Okay, so I'm going to start with this graph, and I hope people can see it. I'm just going to point them. So we're dividing banks into two groups. There's systemically important banks, and there's non-systemically important banks. That's going to be on the horizontal axis. And on the vertical axis is asset size. So we're going to start by saying all banks that are greater than central banker and you're using this framework for your own setup of how you're doing your regulations, you sort of can't turn around now and say, oh, I don't like this framework. So what do we find? We find that using that framework, the best equity, the case at which marginal cost equals marginal benefits is at 22% risk-weighted. But since J.P. Morgan Chase was at 23.5 under the initial proposal, we thought, well, fine, that's close enough. That's close enough for government work. So that's where we got 23.5 for, right? So that's where all these banks that are greater than 250 are going to have to hold 23.5% risk rated, regardless of whether they're deemed systemic or not. I'll explain where that's coming from. Why 250 billion? That was the cutoff in the United States. We'd already decided that 250 billion was something where we're going to treat banks differently. And again, let me just say, if you came back to me and you say, you know something, Feldman, 250 sounds like it's wrong. I think it's 375. I agree. Right? I'm ready to concede on some of these things. If you're something that's not 23.5, it's 22, fine. Okay, 22. There's a lot of margin of error around here. But the key part is that capital, if we want to optimize and have benefits and equal costs, then we want to have it to be higher. Okay, so that's everybody going across the 250 line. Now, under our plan, we're going to tell the Treasury Secretary, you have to go and look at every bank holding company and tell them whether or not they're systemic or not. And again, we're going to use the existing framework, because an existing framework, an existing set of variables that the U.S. you look at to deem the level of systemicness of an institution that's borrowed from the international framework. And we're going to say to the Treasury Secretary, you must deem everybody every year whether they're systemic or not. If you're big, you're going to have to hold more capital, more equity. If you're systemic, when this plan goes in, you're going to have to face a surcharge on top of the 23.5, right? And what we did was we come up with a total of 38%. So by the time we're done, if you remain systemic and you're above 250, if you're systemic at all, then you're going to face, your equity funding is going to be 38%. People hear that and they say, wow, you're taking us back to the 1870s. Nobody has equity funding at that level. Where does that number come from? That's the point at which total benefits and total costs are the same. So it's not on the margin. You're still losing. Each additional amount of equity is going to be less beneficial than the cost, but the total amount is the same. And that would drive, in our calculations, the chance of a bailout down to a chance of a crisis down to 10%. So that's where that's coming from. In our mind, that's going to be a sufficient amount of pressure on the largest institutions that they're actually going to move from being systemic to non-systemic. So we're not only going to have them have more equity funding, but whatever is making them systemic, maybe it's the amount of subsidiaries they have, maybe it's the complexity of their operations in other ways, they're going to change that move over. That's the essence of it. That's the essence of our plan. Much higher equity funding based on benefits and costs with the idea that we're going to drive institutions so that they're no longer systemic. And I'll make one other comment about it. So in the U.S., there is the authority from a group of regulators together where they can deem someone to be systemic, right? So in the U.S., you can be deemed to be systemic either by law, by your asset size, or if you're non-bank, then you get this designation. The one nice thing about our plan, so you get deemed to be systemic, but you're never deemed to be not systemic. You see what I mean? Nobody has to make an affirmative decision and say, you know something, I've decided today that you're not systemic. Under this plan, we're going to require the Treasury Secretary to do that. So they have to go out, they must under law. If they don't, then there's going to be this higher capital charge. It's going to force people to go ahead and make this assessment. So that's the banking part of it. There's other parts too, but I think it's sufficiently complicated already that I'll just leave it at that. The other part of our plan is, what about shadow banks, right? Ideally, what you'd like to do is you'd like to say shadow banks that have a similar risk profile to banks want to hold the same amount of equity. In the U.S., it's very complicated because we're all under different regulatory schemes. So what we did is there's some theoretical work that tries to show you how would you make the funding costs of shadow banks the same as banks. We use that to sort of propose that we would have a tax on leverage for shadow banks. And this just shows you what that would look like. Other than to say, typically we get a question, what about shadow banks? So that's how we would address shadow banks. Shadow banks would have a tax on their leverage that would be sort of functionally equivalent to make their cost of funds the same as it would be for these banks if the banks were at 23.5%. So I'm going to repeat, before I get to my fourth question, I'm going to repeat where the appreciate it.